right now on the Daily Debrief.
But you do commit murder for friends.
Unfortunately.
This man says he helped this defendant kill a doctor because the doctor's husband wanted her dead. Is he lying to save himself?
The difference is that I'm telling the truth.
Plus, accused fiancé murderer Patrick Frazee heads for trial. Also, a verdict in the case of the Hollywood Ripper. Is it death or life without parole? And the deadly shooting of a Tatiana Jefferson. Our experts discuss solutions for the community of Fort Worth. The Daily Debrief brings you the day in court. It's Friday, October 18th.
Welcome, everyone. We begin tonight with the cross-examination of a cooperating defendant in the case of a Florida doctor beaten to death with a hammer. Dr. Teresa Severs did not show up to work, and a friend who checked on her at home found her beaten with a hammer. Nothing, including money, had been taken. Police think her husband asked for help to kill her. Investigators say that husband, Mark Severs, hired his friend, Curtis Wright, and Wright's friend, Jimmy Rogers, to kill the wife. Rogers is on trial. Wright cut a deal and today faced cross-examination. Severs, the husband, faces a separate trial later on. Yesterday, we heard Wright describe the crime. Today, here's how the defense attacked his credibility.
Just my plea deal.
So, in fact, the rest of your life could be at stake based upon that plea deal, correct?
Yes.
And you're charged with second-degree murder, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
While your co-defendants that you mentioned are both facing the death penalty, correct?
Yes.
Yet according to your testimony yesterday, they have no more culpability than you do. Is
Objection
that correct?
Calls for a legal conclusion.
Sustained.
According to your testimony to yesterday, you were all in this together.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But the only difference is with this plea deal, you get a big benefit.
The difference is that I'm telling the truth.
Wright agreed to that plea deal in February 2016. He had been arrested, but Mark Severs and Jimmy Rogers had not. Up until the deal, Wright told law enforcement he was innocent. Rogers' attorney read to Wright what the detective said to him once he finally flipped.
You're not helping yourself, and you're definitely not helping us. We know what happened, but now we need details. Do you recall them saying that to you?
Something, yeah. I don't recall those words, but...
In the first several of those statements, you never mentioned Jimmy Ray Rogers, would you agree? On July 12th, 2015.
Okay, prior to being arrested, yes.
And again on August 27, 2015, you didn't bring up the name of Jimmy Ray Rogers.
No, I was protecting us.
But in fact, law enforcement did bring his name up.
Yes.
And in fact, they kind of laid out a scenario, what they thought happened.
Yes.
But they continued on with this scenario, and in fact, laying blame on Jimmy Ray Rogers, correct? Do you recall that?
No.
Do you recall them telling you that they think maybe Mark and Teresa Severs had some problems?
Yes.
And that she was probably going to leave him.
I'm not sure what the contents of that, okay. of what they said. Everything I said during that statement was to protect us.
And finally, Rogers' defense pressed Wright on the details of Dr. Severs' murder.
Is it your testimony that these were overhead blows, my overhead that it was coming?
I don't believe that's what I said. But
okay. was that your observation or not?
No, some of them were. The murder wasn't a frenzy. How it happened was.
Your plan between you and Mark Severs didn't include a hammer, did it?
No.
In fact, it didn't specifically include any sort of weapon.
No.
A specific weapon.
No, Mark had suggested using a gun, but that was never an option for me.
How come?
I don't use guns. I have a felony. I don't own a gun.
But you do commit murder for friends.
Unfortunately.
Medical examiner said Dr. Severs died from blunt force trauma. On the stand, he described wounds to her head and arms, likely caused by being beat to death with a hammer.
approximately started right here, in the Petrus Ridge, the temporal ridge, and it kind of coursed across diagonally and would have ended up about right here.
What other injury or trauma did you observe with Teresa Sievers?
I had mentioned, of course, the lacerations of the brain, and there were hemorrhages, we call them petechial hemorrhages, throughout the right side of the brain that went inward to some of the deeper brain structures extending into the hindbrain. That, to me, is indicative of significant brain trauma or traumatic axonal injury. It would have been a severe injury to the brain itself. In addition, on her body, she did have bruises that were present on both arms as well as both knees. There was, I believe, a bruise on the right thigh in addition to bruises on the abdomen.
Today on the Law and Crime Network, forensic death examiner Joseph Scott Morgan explained that the prosecutor's theory makes sense.
We can actually, in the morgue, dimensionally marry up the business end of the hammer, the flat area, with the depressed skull fractures, which she has many of. They look like a quarter, essentially. And so what does the business end of this thing look like? Well, it's kind of shaped like a quarter. It's roughly the same dimensions. And it will actually marry that on the surface of the bone. It takes a tremendous amount of force in order to generate this injury. This is something that you're commonly going to see in cases of motor vehicle accidents, falls from great heights, and of course with a hammer strike like this, particularly if it's done over and over and over again, which in this case it was. This is a dynamic kind of death of dance that they're doing, kind of circling perhaps, and she's being struck in all direction on all attitudes of her head. And as you do that, you put any substance under enough stress, including bone, and finally it's going to give way. If there's enough energy applied in this particular case, there was. And this is just a horrific, horrific case.
With us tonight are attorneys Gene Rossi in Washington, Michael Bryant in New York, and Eklund Mercy in Atlanta. So, Eklund, this is just a brutal killing that we're hearing described from the expert on the stand and our expert as well there.
Absolutely. And we're just hearing what happened. The jury actually sees the autopsy pictures in conjunction to what Dr. Sievers looked like beforehand and what she looked like upon her death. So the jury's seeing everything. They're seeing her before and they're seeing how vibrant she is, to also seeing her what she looks like after being bludgeoned with a hammer. So it's pretty gruesome for the jury.
Oh, it's horrible. Michael Bryant, what do you make of the defense tactic here? The defense tactic is basically to point at the cooperating witness and say, hey, wait a minute, if my guy was really involved, you should have named him a lot sooner than you really did. We think you're lying to try to save your own hide. Is that effective?
Yeah, you know, the jury's got to disbelieve the cooperating defendant. That's really what it comes down to, because maybe it's just as easy to believe he did it and Rogers was just kind of a fall guy that he rolled over on to get himself a 25-year deal, because he figured, hey, if they prove I did it, I'm going for death or prison for life. So, yeah, the jury's got to assess this guy, believe him, and fall on Jimmy Rogers with the blame.
Gene Rossi, former federal prosecutor here. So, Gene, I thought the cross was relatively effective in that one line that the cooperating defendant uttered. He said, I was protecting us. And that's why he didn't name this defendant earlier on. If he's protecting us, then how do we take that? Something about that struck me as odd. Did it jump out to you?
Well, that there's no definition of us. It could be someone other than Jimmy Rogers. It could be someone other than Mark Sievers. But I want to bear down on one thing. Juries understand that before someone is arrested and they're approached by police, or right after they're approached, they will omit a lot of things. But once a defendant agrees to cooperate, when Wainwright cooperates, and then he doesn't mention Jimmy Rogers, and then he fails to mention his conspirators, that really hurts credibility. But I think juries get that in the beginning, when the police come by to knock on the door, you're going to say, I'm innocent, nobody else was involved. I think juries understand that.
It took a long time for the names to actually spill out, though, here. So, Eklund, the big picture question from a moral standpoint, I guess, is whether it's fair for two defendants to be sitting there facing the death penalty and then this cooperating defendant to have that completely off the table. Is that fair?
Well, as a defense attorney, I'm going to say depending on who my client is. But it's just how is it? Who do I have? But is it fair? Depending on what you're looking at, you can testify to exactly what happened. And had he not gotten the deal, we would not have known what happened in the last moments of Dr. Seavers' life.
We wouldn't have much of anything, exactly. So look, we're gonna move along now. A Colorado man accused of murdering his fiance last year appeared in court for the final time before his trial begins. Prosecutors say Patrick Frazee beat Kelsey Barrett to death with a baseball bat. Crystal Kenny is the state's key witness. She says she was having an affair with Frazee when he asked her to poison Barrett and beat her, but that she never went through with it. Prosecutors say Frazee's the one who burned Barrett's body. Her remains have never been found. After 3 days of deliberations, a California jury has recommended the death penalty for the man prosecutors say attacked 11 women. The same jury convicted Michael Gargiulo of murdering two women who lived near him and of attempting to kill a third. The final victim survived being attacked in her own bed. Gargiulo will also likely be tried in Illinois for other crimes. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, we look back at a difficult week in Fort Worth, Texas, after this woman was shot and killed through her own bedroom window by a police officer. We discuss reform and the case that's building against the man who pulled the trigger. Overnight tonight marks 1 week since Tatiana Jefferson was shot and killed by a Fort Worth, Texas police officer. Jefferson's neighbor called 911 because her door was open. Officer Aaron Dean arrived, never announced his presence, and started walking around her property with a flashlight. When he eventually encountered her through a bedroom window, he ordered her to show her hands and fired just 2 seconds later. Dean was hired in 2017 and became a sworn officer in 2018. He resigned before his superiors could fire him and was arrested for murder shortly thereafter. He's out on bond but has not been formally indicted by a grand jury. All of our guests are here to discuss this case, but we begin with New York law professor Kirk Burkhalter and Pastor Tori Franklin in Fort Worth. Pastor Franklin, you spoke at the Fort Worth City Council meeting this week. Let's look at one of the speakers and your reaction in that meeting.
You want to silence me and shut me down. And I'm not okay with that. My wife's not okay with that. My kids are not okay with that. I'm a member of this community, born and raised. And for you to look at me and try to get these officers, whom I don't feel safe right now because they're pretty close to me right now.
But you're not speaking on the tax side.
What tells me you didn't get it is because, for one, this agenda that we had here tonight could have been pushed off to another day, because your city is hurting. Your city is in pain. Your city is right now struggling, and you want to carry out a long agenda. Do you really get it that we want accountability? Because there's no way in the world an officer who is trained is held to a lower standard than a civilian. If we go and kill somebody the same way, we're going to go to jail, and we're going to be put in jail for life.
Pastor Franklin, I've never been to your city, so it's really hard for me to judge what's happening on the ground. But from where I sit, the optics could not have been worse, with the police crowding the speakers there at that meeting under the caveat, well, we need to move things along because there's an agenda. Looking back at it, do you think you set the right tone in answering the concerns of the community?
I believe we did. The main objective in that meeting was to get our voices heard, to get the community to speak so that they're aware of how the community is feeling. And unfortunately, at that time, it seemed as though we were going on with as business as usual. And the unfortunate thing with that is this is not business as usual. You know, the community has been impacted greatly from these events. And it's not just this event, it's the culmination of events throughout the years that have occurred with Fort Worth PD. And so this was a moment that we really, really felt should have been a moment for the city to grieve, for an opportunity for the city to heal, not not in a mass attempt or in a hurried attempt to get back to regular business.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you said what a lot of people were thinking, saying, hey, look, City Council, let's address this first, then approve your contracts. I mean, basically, I think the City Council did it backwards. Kirk Burkhalter, former detective, now professor of law. Let's talk about the type of call here. The neighbor who called police called because he wanted officers to check on a Tatiana Jefferson. In some agencies, that would have been called a check on the welfare sort of call, but dispatchers in Fort Worth coded it as an open structure call. There's been a lot of complaints made this week about the difference between those calls.
So generally, an open structure call, a wellness call, the difference is that these calls are not really calls where the police are coming because a crime is in progress, meaning that no one is in danger. Perhaps a crime could be in progress because, you know, you left your door unlocked, but no one's in danger. Those are different types of calls. So the abandoned structure is also a rather vague call from our point of view. So it's unclear what the officers were tasked to do.
Pastor, your concern is how the police interact with your community. Does reform need to start by not escalating these calls up the chain? Where does it go from here in that regard?
I believe the first step is to develop rapport and relationship with the community. The unfortunate thing is oftentimes officers that are coming to our communities are either very inexperienced or very detached from our community. So there's not open dialogue. There's really not as much relationship that the community undergoes with the police force. And in the occasions where there is that relationship, it's a noticeable difference. The officers are able to do a lot more in the community, and the community is able to connect a lot more with law enforcement. But in these situations, unfortunately, when that relationship has not been established prior to interactions, it appears as though, and it gives a sense and a feeling as though the officers are coming into the community and they're entering into a war zone. And so there's an undercurrent of immediate conflict that we really want to eradicate and get away from, because that, I believe, is helping fuel a lot of these negative encounters.
Professor Burkhalter, does training solve this?
To a certain extent. So, you know, the pastor's concerns are certainly valid. However, the concerns also go further here. So either, you know, initially there may have been a lapse in training, or there was certainly training and the officers weren't following it. If you look at the body cam footage, the officers pass an open door and the home is clearly lit inside, and made a choice to circle around the house with their tactical flashlights and peer through the windows. So this tactically doesn't appear to be the best course of action. First course of action for any police officer arriving on the scene is concealment, containment, and rather than kind of rushing in. So I think it's a little bit of both. What it communicates to the community is that there may be two sets of rules for one community and another, but certainly it all begins with training.
And I know, Professor, we were saying earlier before the broadcast that when confronted with a gun, the officer could have ducked for cover rather than pulled the trigger because there was a wall there. Pastor, I want to ask you finally here. A lot of people are saying this should be a murder case. We're waiting to see what a grand jury does. Does the community there in Fort Worth, the community with whom you interact, think this should be a murder case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We believe that this is one of the clearest cases for murder, because I do agree with the training aspect, and oftentimes the training and the approach to situations, they're not conducted the same way as with other neighborhoods or other communities. So when we look at this, absolutely, the community feels as though this is definitely a murder.
Pastor and Professor, we appreciate your input here on The Debrief. We're going to move along because the rest of our guests are here once again. I'm going to ask everyone the same question here. Legally, is this a murder case? And does the officer have any defense saying he was pointing his flashlight in the window unannounced, then encountered someone who is said to have had a gun and fired? Gene Rossi, you start.
With the utmost respect to the pastor, and it always makes me distraught when there's a police shooting. I think this is a classic case of manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, reckless disregard. Murder, I assume you're talking first degree. You need premeditation, malice aforethought. I don't think that officer had premeditation and malice aforethought when he went there and he pointed the gun and pulled the trigger.
Eklund Mercy.
I'm going to have to agree with Mr. Rossi in the sense that we don't have the same facts as Amber Geiger, which, you know, it's just negligent hiring. It was, you know, it was just reckless in how he went about it. He was called for a welfare check. Instead of bringing a medicine bag, he brought a gun. So I think that they'll be able to get manslaughter, but I don't know about the murder.
We're going to have to see how this all plays out. Michael Bryant, your thoughts.
Yeah, I would agree for different reasons, though. I think, and I thought Amber Geiger was a manslaughter case as well. I think even if you find that the officer intended to shoot to kill, I think there's a self-defense element because we now know that there was at least believed to be a gun in the hand of the ultimate victim. That might mitigate any attempt to find murder and make it manslaughter, too.
I want to bring Kirk Burkhalter back into this discussion if I can, because, Professor, we were talking earlier, and I want to make sure we get this across. Why did the officer resign before he had a chance to be fired? You have a strong opinion on that.
Yes. So, you know, certainly I didn't speak to the officer or his attorney. However, in almost every law enforcement agency across the country, there is a mandate that when an officer is involved in a shooting, they must give a statement within 48, 72 hours quite often. And that's a condition of employment. So whether it has nothing to do with one's Fifth Amendment rights. So you're mandated to give a statement. You're going to be questioned. What occurred? What happened? The effect of the police officer resigning means that he is now an average citizen and he cannot be compelled to provide testimony against himself. The Fifth Amendment applies. So we may never hear from him. So, you know, possibly I would say that's probably exactly why he would have resigned.
So some strategery, I guess, is the word that we used to use in law school. It's not a real word. Your law school, I know, is more, you wouldn't let a student use the word strategery.
No.
But that's what we used to say. Appreciate everybody's insight here on The Debrief. Professor Burkhalter, the rest of the panel, Eklund Mercy, Gene Rossi, Michael Bryant, and of course, Pastor Franklin from Fort Worth, Texas. Thank you very much for your time here on The Debrief. We will continue to monitor that case and the others that we're watching here on the Law and Crime Network. That's it for us this week. Live trial coverage resuming Monday at 9 o'clock Eastern. The Debrief, of course, back live on the network at 5 o'clock Eastern. We will see you then. Have a good weekend.